So we've been walking through the life of Abraham, and we are 1 week away from the end of that series. We'll be capping this series off next week, but we've been talking about when God comes close, because Abraham, you know, is really a pivotal figure in the scriptures, and God came near to him a number of times. We've seen over about 25 years of his life where God has been promising him time and time again a people and a place. A land and an offspring. And so God has given Abraham over and over again this promise that he was going to have a son. And today in Genesis 20, it's going to be very simple. I'm going to tell you about one thing we need to remember about God, and then what happens if we forget that, and what happens if we remember it. And that's basically how Genesis 20 unfolds. One thing to remember about God, what happens if we forget that, and what happens if we remember it? So I'm going to dive right in without further ado. What is the one thing to remember about God in this text? It is this, that God is working to keep his promises even when we can't see it and don't feel like we know it. God is working to keep his promises in ways we don't know and can't see. That's incredibly comforting if you know anything about God's promises. And that's the first part of this story, that God is working to keep his promises in ways that Abraham doesn't know and can't see. We see that in the first 7 verses of the text. And these verses will melt the most cynical heart if you see what's going on. See, Abraham was still sojourning. He's still traveling, as Dan read for us. He's not yet settled. He's in the promised land, but he hasn't really come home. And so he's living in between the promise of God to have this land and the reality of actually possessing it. So he's in this in-between time. He's waiting. He's living in the gap, you could say. And he's there in this place called Gerar, where verse 2, he says of Sarah, his wife, "She is my sister." And Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. Now, there's some background to that. The background... if you look at just at verse 2, there's like very little by way of explanation of what's going on. Why did he say that? Why did Abimelech take his wife? And the reason that there's not any more explanation there is because this kind of thing has already happened to Abraham once before. And if you were reading right through Genesis starting at the beginning, you would have come through Genesis chapter 12. And in Genesis 12, what happened is Abraham and Sarah were headed down to Egypt because there was a famine in the land, and they were about to cross over the border into Egypt. And he said to Sarah, "I know that you're a woman beautiful in appearance, and when the Egyptians see you, they will say, 'This is his wife.' Then they will kill me, but they will let you live. Say you are my sister, that it may go well with me because of you, and that my life may be spared for your sake." So in other words, as we'll see later in Genesis 20 as well, Abraham's looking at his wife, who by the way is like 80-some years old, and is saying, "You're so beautiful that they're going to take you from me and kill me so that they can have you. So just say, you're my sister." And that's actually what happened in Egypt. Pharaoh took Sarah into his harem, but God sent a plague on Pharaoh and on his house because of it. And somehow, Pharaoh figures out why this plague has come, and he asks Abraham why Abraham lied to him. And we don't know how Abraham answered that time, but Pharaoh gave Sarah back to Abraham and sent them on their way. So this kind of episode has already happened once in Abraham's life. And he should have known better by the time we get to Genesis 20 to try this again. He should have known that he didn't have to protect himself in this way. But in the meanwhile, in verses 1 through 7, or really 3 through 7, in the midst of Abraham's self-protective, fearful deception, God is working. You see that in Abimelech. God was working in ways that Abraham couldn't see and didn't know. Look with me at verse 3. God comes to Abimelech in a dream. He says, "Behold, you're a dead man because of the woman whom you have taken, for she is a man's wife." How terrifying would that be if you dreamt that tonight? God says to you in your dream, you're a dead man. That's what happens to Abimelech. But as yet, Sarah was just in Abimelech's house. He had not yet touched her. And so he answered God in the dream, Lord, will you kill an innocent people? Did he not tell me that she was his sister? And she herself said, he is my brother. In the integrity of my heart and in my innocence, I have done this. He's pleading with God, don't kill me. I didn't know. They lied. And God says to him in a dream, in the same dream, yes, I know that you have done this in the integrity of your heart. And it was I who kept you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her. Now then, return the man's wife, for he is a prophet, so that he'll pray for you and you shall live. But if you do not return her, know that you shall surely die, you and all who are yours. Now notice four things there about God's work with Abimelech that Abraham couldn't see and didn't know. There's four things to notice. One is that God kept Abimelech from sinning. God says very clearly, it was I who kept you from sinning against me. Breaking the marriage bond is a sin against God. A sin is a transgression, it's a trespass, it's a law breaking. When King David committed adultery with Bathsheba, he prayed to God. He said, against you, you only have I sinned. But God kept Abimelech from that sin. He protected him. God graciously restrained Abimelech. God didn't have to do that. Abimelech's intent, of course, with taking Sarah was to know her sexually. But God kept that from happening. He restrained Abimelech from sinning. Why? Because God had made a promise to Abraham that he was going to keep, that Abraham and Sarah were going to have a son. That's really beautiful, that God keeps us from sinning based on his promise to himself that he's going to keep. And so God is able and is always working to keep sin in check and to keep his plan on track. God's always working, and he's able to keep sin in check and to keep his plan on track. And that means that whatever evil comes our way, it's not because God is unable or unwilling to stop it. It's because somehow it fits into his plan. He's going to use it for his purposes. He is sovereign over it, even if we can't see it. That's comforting when evil comes our way, right? So Abraham and Sarah couldn't see it, but God was working to keep Abimelech from sinning. And then second, they couldn't see that God came near to Abimelech. They didn't know that this happened in Abimelech's dream. They didn't know the grace of God to come and speak to Abimelech. God didn't have to do that. He could do whatever he wanted, but God is merciful. And Abimelech was innocent in this situation, so God, by his grace, came near to Abimelech. But Abraham and Sarah couldn't have known that. Third thing that they couldn't have known that God was doing behind the scenes, God promised Abimelech a blessing for obedience. God doesn't just say, give Sarah back. He says, give her back, and this man is a prophet, and he'll pray for you, and you'll live. So there's a blessing in the obedience that Abraham and Sarah could not have known that God was saying this to Abimelech. And fourth, in God's gracious working, that was invisible to Sarah and Abraham, God warned Abimelech of the consequences of disobedience. He said to him, if you don't return her, I will kill you and all who are yours. Now that may not sound very gracious to you, right? I've just been saying this is God's grace to warn them, and then he says, if you do not obey me, I will kill you and all in your household. But it is entirely within God's right to do that. An artist has every right to destroy their own painting. A programmer has every right to delete what he's written or she's written. And God has every right, a creator has every right to do whatever he wants with his creation. It's completely within his right. And regardless of whether Abimelech knew that he was sinning and having this woman in his home, it was still against God's law. So God did not have to warn him, did not have to be gracious to him. But he was, and he warns him. And Abimelech hears that. So God kept Abimelech from sinning, which Abraham and Sarah could not have known. Sarah knew that it hadn't happened, right? he came near to Abimelech in a dream. He promised blessings for obedience to his command, and God warned of the curse that would come from disobedience. All of this is God's gracious work in the pagan king Abimelech's life, and it was totally invisible to Abraham and Sarah. They didn't know it. They couldn't see that, but God was working. And God is always working in ways that we don't see and can't know. There was a time when the Apostle Paul was headed to do ministry in one area. He had in mind that this is what God wanted him to do, and this was the plan. And on the way there, he had a dream, and a person from Macedonia said, "Come over here and help us." God had been at work in Macedonia in ways that Paul was not aware of, that he wasn't privy to until that dream happened. And so then Paul redirected. God is always working in ways that we don't see and can't know. There have been times in my own life when I've prayed over a situation where there was conflict and I was really dreading a conversation, and then I would meet up with the person and I'm thinking, okay, I've got to bring up this thing. But then they bring it up and they've already thought over it and they're ready to reconcile. They're apologizing. Has this ever happened to you? You've been anxious about something and then you pray to God, you ask him to bring about reconciliation, and he does before you're even ready for it. God's always working in ways that we don't see and that we can't know. There's been all kinds of times in my life when I found that God had been working behind the scenes in ways that I couldn't have imagined. God is always working in ways we don't know and can't see. That person maybe in your life that you want to share Christ with but seems so far gone might already have God working in their lives in ways you can't see and don't know. The ultimate example of this is the cross of Christ. At the cross of Jesus Christ, it looked, didn't it, like God was not working. It looked like defeat. When Jesus was bleeding there, right, with holes in his hands and his feet, it looked like it was over. Like it had all come to nothing. So much so that on Easter Sunday morning, Mary Magdalene comes to look for his body, and she's weeping because it's gone, and she turns to the man that she thinks is the gardener with tears streaming down her face. She says, "If you've took him, tell me where you took him, because I'm going to take him. Let me take care of his body." So grieved over this loss. And then the man who she thought was the gardener said, what'd he say? He said, "Mary." And then she realized she was talking to the resurrected Jesus. On the cross, it looked like God was absent. Like he had left. Like God was silent. And in the darkness of that hour, even then, God was working. Even then, especially then, on the cross, Jesus won victory over death by dying. He conquered by suffering. Other people were mocking him. You know, he saved others. He can't save himself. God's always working, even when it looks like he's not. So the first thing is, the thing to remember is, God is working to keep his promises in ways that we don't know and can't see. Now, what happens if we forget that? If we forget that, we waver in the wilderness, we waver in the gap between the promise and the reality, and we become uncharitable and fearful. And that happens with Abraham. The very next day, verse 8, Abimelech gets up early from this dream, and he tells his servants what he dreamed by night, and everybody's terrified. He calls Abraham and asks him why he lied, why he put him in this situation. And this is what Abraham says, verse 11, "I did it because I thought there is no fear of God at all in this place." Why'd you do it, Abraham? Why'd you lie to me? Why'd you say all this? I did it because I thought there's no fear of God at all in this place, and they'll kill me because of my wife. Besides, she is, listen to this, she is indeed my sister, the daughter of my father, though not the daughter of my mother, and she became my wife. So it's half true. And when God caused me to wander from my father's house, I said to her, this is the kindness you must do to me. At every place which we come, say of me, he is my brother. So Abraham did this, told this lie, protected himself, because he didn't trust God to keep his promise and didn't believe that God could be working in Abimelech's household. And as a result, Abraham felt like he had to take matters into his own hands, like he had to protect himself, like he had to take care of himself. And that's true if God isn't faithful. If God is not faithful, if God's not involved, if God's not always working, then we always do have to look out for ourselves. And I think this is why many of us suffer. Many of us just feel this need to control things. We're not prepared to risk or to suffer well under the hand of God. We haven't prepared people well for that. Abraham's assumption is that there's no fear of God in this place, verse 11. He's self-centered in this. He's small-hearted about it. He's fearful. He's uncharitable. And we're all so like this. He says, you know, there's no way God could be working here. God has spoken to me, but how is he going to be working here in this place? And we are all so much like this. We assume that there's no way God could be working in that person over there who's not like us. We get like this, it's the default, we get like it even in church. We can assume that I'm the only person in this church that has the relationship with God that I do, and all y'all, you know, we can feel like God's not really speaking there. Or we get factions in churches. These are the people who really know where God has spoken to us, and we're not sure if God has spoken to others, if he's moving by others. We do this even in church. We do it within churches. We get like this with people outside of our tribes. You know, whatever our tribe might be, it could be a theological tribe, could be any kind of tribe. But there are theological tribes in Christianity. Now, there's nothing wrong with having a theological system. I think everybody here should have a theological system. And just frankly and honestly, I think it should be mine, right? I mean, that's why I preach. Just to be totally honest about my agenda, I think it should be, you know, not just mine, but the one I've found. But sometimes we Christians get around our theological tribes or our, you know, our whatever our thing is that we're into, and we wouldn't say it out loud, but if we were really honest with ourselves and really honest with God, we would say, you know, we are the people who really have heard from God, and I'm not so sure that there's fear of God over here. And I'm just talking about in like the church. We get this us versus them thing. Now, then you start thinking about how we can be with non-Christians sometimes. And we think, we forget that non-Christians, like in this case, Abimelech, who is outside the promises of God, has on this day, Abimelech has a much better sense of who God is than Abraham does. And it could be, you know, we forget that non-Christians who are made in the image of God may have a better sense of who God is on a particular day than even we might as Christians. Maybe they're more gracious. Maybe they have a stronger marriage. Maybe they exhibit more humility than we do. See, being a Christian is not about being superior, but we can often make it like that. Being a Christian is not that, though. It's about acknowledging that you are inferior to God and in many ways to everybody else. The Apostle Paul calls himself the chief of sinners. Some of us say we're the chief of sinners, but then we go and act and talk like those people are worse off than us. It's what happens when we forget that God is at work, even when we can't see it, even when we don't know it, that he might be at work in other people when we can't see it, is we become uncharitable. We become unloving towards people. We actually have a smaller view of God in that case. We assume very little of God, that he's not working over there because we can't see it. It becomes self-centered. It becomes about protecting me and my tribe. It becomes small-hearted. It becomes arrogant. It becomes fearful. It's all about deepening the moat between us and them so that I can feel secure. Abraham assumed that there is no fear of God in the place. Meanwhile, God was speaking directly to Abimelech. On this day, Abimelech was more faithful than Abraham. And it's wrong of Abraham, therefore, to assume that. And it's wrong of us. And you and I have been guilty of this. We've all been guilty of this. Why do we assume that God is not working in others or in our present circumstances? Why do we assume that? What does it say about what we really believe about God if we assume that he's not at work in other people or in our present circumstances? Why do we get dragged into us versus them arguments? I'm preaching to myself here. Since when is Christianity about proving that I'm right? The call of the Bible is for us to decrease, for Christ to increase. The call of the Christian life is to trust that God is working even in people we couldn't expect him to be working in, and even in the hard times. The call is to be gracious to people. It's not to be cynical or suspicious toward others. It's to trust God in all that he said, no matter how bleak things might seem in the present. Now, Abraham had the promise of God. He should not have doubted that, but we do. We're like Abraham. And when we doubt God's word and we take matters into our own hands, sin always multiplies. We hurt and deceive people. We fail to love. We dishonor God by making him smaller than he is. And if Abraham had the promise of God that he was going to have a son, which he did, we have even greater reason to trust God in the dangerous times, in the seemingly evil times. The Apostle Paul puts it like this in 2 Corinthians. He says, "So we do not lose heart." Are you in a spot where you're not sure if God's working? Paul says, "So we do not lose heart, though our outer self is wasting away, our inner self is being renewed day by day. For this light momentary affliction is preparing us for an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison, as we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are unseen are eternal. For we know that if the tent that is our earthly home is destroyed, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens." Even if we come to die, well, when we come to die, we know we have a tent that is eternal in the heavens. We will be with Christ forever. One day we'll be with him in our resurrected bodies with him. We look for things that are unseen. And when you live for things that are unseen and you try to look from that eternal perspective about how God sees the world, looking not on the outside but looking on the heart, it frees you up to love people because you don't have to protect yourself anymore. Have you told anybody any lie about how you're doing today? Here. I have, okay? Does anybody else want to join me in confession right now? Oh, you've all been honest. Good. Sometimes we get like that, but we have a hope in the heavens that means you don't have to protect yourself anymore. You don't have to be anything other than what you are because Jesus died instead of us. And he got up out of the grave. And he was raised from the dead to ascend to the right hand of God. And now he sits at the right hand of God on the throne from which he rules over creation. He's working in ways that we can't see, that we can't know. So Jesus said, "My Father is working until now, and I am working." Always assume that God is working in ways you don't know and can't see because he always is. And if you don't, you'll become fearful, small-hearted, self-centered. But on the other hand, what happens if we do remember? If we remember that God is working, or by God's grace, when he breaks through and forces us to see that he's working, then we'll overflow with generosity, with love, with kindness, with honesty. And we see that in Abraham. By the time we get to verse 14 in the chapter, it's become apparent to everybody in this story, in this episode in Abraham's life, it's become apparent to everybody that God has been working, that God has been in the midst of this. Abimelech, for his part, verse 14, takes sheep and oxen and male servants and female servants and gives them to Abraham, returns Sarah's wife to him. And he says, behold, my land is before you, dwell where it pleases you. And to Sarah, he says, verse 16, behold, I have given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. It is a sign of your innocence in the eyes of all who are with you, and before everyone, you are vindicated. When you see that God has been working, it makes you overflow in generosity. God only asked Abimelech to give Sarah back, but Abimelech pours out blessing. He says, look, God has saved my life, and I'm so thankful for that. Here, have a bunch of stuff. Go live wherever you want. He just is overflowing in generosity as a result of this encounter with God. And that's what happens even today. When the grace of God enters your life, when you accept that God has freely offered his son for you instead of you on the cross, that Christ paid the penalty for your sin, that you get this free gift of salvation, when you accept that Jesus is the Lord who died for you and instead of you, when that grace comes home to a person, it always makes you overflow with grace. You know, Jesus told that parable about the one who is, well, he told a parable. He also told it about one time when there was a prostitute who was weeping and wiping his feet with her hair. And they said, you know, why? What's up with her? All the religious people in the room said, what's her deal, Jesus? Why are you allowing this to happen? He said, the one who's been forgiven much loves much. Cares much. When the grace of God enters your life, when God has encountered you in his graciousness, you overflow with grace. If you've been changed by God's grace, you'll be generous with your money and your possessions. You'll be generous with your home and your time. You'll extend yourself to give. Abraham, that's Abimelech. Abraham, for his part, prays to God, and God heals Abimelech and his family so that they could once again have children, because all of them had been caused to be infertile, which tells you that this situation that we just read in one chapter was at least 3 to 6 months, if not 12 months long. I mean, these days, if you're not unable to have a child, unable to conceive for 12 months, until 12 months have gone by, they're not going to call you infertile. So God says right here, verse 18, the Lord had closed all the wombs of the house of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. This, you know, this was not just an overnight thing. This was over a series of months. And Abraham, by this scenario, is changed. He's humbled. He's learned that there is fear of God in this place. He prays to God, and God pours out more blessing on this formerly pagan king, this one that Abraham that had feared, the one that Abraham assumed God wasn't working with. And when you remember that God is working, when you've seen it a few times, when you remember it in the cross and resurrection, that God is always working, that Jesus is on the throne, it makes you charitable and generous and willing to bless. When your life is truly God-centered, you'll be big-hearted and full of hope overflowing to other people and not uncharitable and fearful. And that's what we're called to be as Christians. We have every reason to be it as Christians. So God is working to keep his promises in ways that we don't know and can't see. If we forget that, we'll waver in the waiting and become uncharitable, unloving, unkind, fearful, self-protecting. But if we remember it, that God is always working, we'll be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord. We'll overflow with charity and generosity and blessing. And God is always working to keep his promises. You know, one thing that's true here is your sin can't keep God from keeping God's promises. Your sin can't keep God from keeping God's promises. God is so faithful here. Abraham sins, but God keeps his promise. God is going to do what God has committed himself to do, and there's nothing you or I can do to stop it. That's great news if you know him. And we see it supremely at the cross. We sing, it was my sin that held him there until it was accomplished. His dying breath has brought me life. I know that it is finished. Our sin kept him there for God's purpose and promise to be fulfilled. And so, when we remember that God is always working in ways we can't see and don't know, but he's always working, we can walk with faith. We can love our enemies. We can pray for those who persecute us, whatever comes our way. We can find hope on the darkest days. If you'll remember that God is always working to keep his promises in ways we don't know and can't see, it will change you. It will lead you to invest heavily in the church, which is God's plan A for reaching the world with the gospel. I don't just mean financially, but energy, time. It'll lead you to be charitable rather than confrontational in your relationships, always assuming that God is at work in the other person. If you remember that God is always working to keep his promises, it'll help you to endure anything. You'll be able to say with Paul, we're afflicted in every way, but not crushed. Perplexed, but not driven to despair. Persecuted, but not forsaken. Struck down, but not destroyed. If you will remember that God is always working to keep his promises in ways you can't see and don't know, it will help you take risks for God's greater glory. Maybe that's sharing the gospel with somebody. Maybe it's just stepping outside of your comfort zone to love somebody, meet somebody somewhere. If you remember that God is always working to keep his promises, it'll drive you to know more and more of the Bible because you want to know what God's promises are. You want to have them inside you so that you know what you can bank on. It'll drive you to more specific and earnest prayer because you'll know that if anything of eternal consequence is going to get done, if any of the heart things, the things we can't see are going to get done, God's going to have to do them. If you remember that God is always working to keep his promises, it'll make you care for the poor more because you know that God has a heart for the poor and is working on their behalf. It'll make you a more confident and winsome evangelist because you'll know that the same God who has commanded you to go has also promised to be with you and go before you. I've had the privilege of at least one time in my life thinking I was going to be evangelizing somebody to have them tell me, I've actually just become a Christian. If you'll go knowing that God is going to keep his promises, that he's already working in ways that you can't see and don't know, you'll be able to go with confidence and winsomeness in evangelism because you'll know you don't have to save anybody. You just need to sow the seed and God may already be working. If you remember that God is always working to keep his promises, it'll make you want to be around people who are different from you, but who know God. Different from you in personality, appearance, and culture, because there's maybe something they see about God that you don't see from where you're sitting. At the cross, when God seemed to be working the least, God was working the most. And Jesus is now sitting at the right hand of God, on the throne. That's the point of the ascension. He's now seated there, ruling over everything and everyone. See, Jesus Christ is Lord. That's our confession. He is Lord. In evangelism, we try to persuade people of that truth, but it is the truth. And what it means to be a Christian is to be one who says, Jesus is Lord. Over everyone. It'll make you more gentle. It'll make you more confident. And if you've yet to submit to Jesus' lordship and receive him as your Savior, talk to any one of us up here or someone sitting next to you and let us help you remove whatever obstacles might be in your way. Remember, Jesus said, my Father is working until now, and I am working. That will change you. Remember it. Let's pray.